Try to live at the intersection of what you love to do and what you're really good at. And if you can be at that crossroads, enough money will find its way to your door. And I always thought that was good advice, because if you're really good at something and you love it, you're just going to perform better at it. You'll be a little more diligent around it. And so that was good advice to me. In fact, I've given that advice to other people that I got from my dad many years ago.
Welcome to The Distribution by Juniper Square, where I sit down with leaders across private markets. I'm your host, Brandon Sedloff. On today's episode, I sit down with Larry Hurd, CEO of Transwestern Companies, a privately held national real estate firm with global reach. Larry and I dig into Transwestern's evolution and his career at the firm, the synergies that exist when building a real estate company that combines development, investment management, and brokerage, and Larry's principles of leadership and how they've helped him and Transwestern navigate many cycles. I enjoyed my conversation with Larry and know that you will as well. Let's get into it. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Brandon. Good to see you again.
So for our guests that don't know you, can you introduce yourself and the organization that you're a part of, please?
Sure. Larry Hurd, I'm the CEO of Transwestern, our family of companies, and we are a privately held national real estate firm with global reach, and we do lots of different things that I'm sure we're going to be talking about today.
We will. Yeah, I'm excited for this conversation. So you've been at Transwestern for 41 years, but before Transwestern...
Thanks a lot.
Yeah, for the reminder, I know. pretty impressive. So before Transwestern, let's talk a little bit about kind of where'd you grow up? You know, let's get to know you. Where'd you grow up? How'd you get into the real estate business?
Well, I was born and raised in Houston, Texas. Still reside here today with my wife and family. Grew up here and then went to Baylor University in Waco, Texas, which is located between Houston and Dallas. And came back. I actually got a BBA in finance and came back to Houston. Had the very good fortune of meeting my wife of now 41 years, Caroline, at Baylor. And when we married, we moved back to Houston. So I've been in Houston pretty much this whole time, even though we have a lot of reach around the country. We move around a little bit, but we've called this home.
Excellent. So after Baylor, what was your next move after you graduated from college? And did you always know that you wanted to go into real estate, or kind of what led you into a career in real estate?
Well, you know, when I was 5 years old, it wasn't policeman, fireman, astronaut, commercial real estate executive. So I did not grow up thinking I was going to be in the real estate business. In fact, my father was a lawyer and a judge for many years, and his brothers were all lawyers, and one of my grandfathers was an attorney. So when I went to college, I thought maybe I'd end up going to law school. But when I went to Baylor, I gravitated more towards business and commerce. I found that very interesting and was sort of motivated by that. So I went that business degree, earned that BBA degree, and was just always sort of fascinated with the flows of business and commerce. And I still did not have an idea of what I was going to do with that degree. In fact, it was my senior year. Before my senior year, I had an internship with a local real estate developer in Houston, Joe A. McDermott, Inc., who built shopping centers and apartments and office buildings. And I went and worked with him and his company, Fine Company, during that summer. And I was immediately captivated by the pace of the business and the variety of everything that you did during the day. And all it was a development firm. So, you know, we'd go from trying to buy some land to go to meet the architects, the contractors, then we had to get everything leased at some point. And it was just the pace, the variety, the fact that you had to build so many relationships so quickly. That just really appealed to me. So it really wasn't until then that I decided I wanted to, I think I can make a living in this business.
And was that internship in Houston? Is that where?
It was. Yep. In fact, and then they made an offer for me to start right when I graduated. So my first job out of Baylor in 1980 was with Joe A. McDermott, and I joined Transwestern in 1983. So I've only had two jobs during that span of time.
Wow. What did your family think, out of curiosity, family of lawyers and judges, and here you are going a very different business route?
Yeah, you know, it was very interesting, very encouraging, very empowering. Everyone was with me and my three siblings. I'm the oldest of four. I have two younger sisters and a younger brother. It was all about trying to figure out what your potential was, what you had a passion for. My dad had this great saying when I was growing up and when I was in college. He said, try to live at the intersection of what you love to do and what you're really good at. And if you can be at that crossroads, enough money will find its way to your door. And I always thought that was good advice, because if you're really good at something and you love it, you're just going to perform better at it. You'll be a little more diligent around it. And so that was good advice to me. In fact, I've given that advice to other people that I got from my dad many years ago. But that was sort of real estate was kind of late on the scene for me, almost before I graduated, before I decided I wanted to do it.
Yeah. So when you joined McDermott, that was the early 80s, right?
Yes.
And the world was, you know, the real estate world wasn't in, you know, an ideal place. What were you kind of doing? What was Houston like at that time? Kind of what do you remember from those early experiences?
Yeah, no, in 80, it was actually good. So Houston was booming. The energy business was booming. There's an interesting statistic that, let's see, in 1980, I forget the number, whatever the office product in Houston that existed, call it 60 million feet at the time, we built another 60 million feet between 80 and 85, doubled the inventory in the office market. So the first few years, all of them with McDermott, there was no talk about a recession or anything else. And then my first year or two with Transwestern were okay. And then we were hit pretty hard with that mid-80s crash. So I still love the business, but I would argue that the S&L crisis of the mid-80s, which was one of about four or five, probably five cycles, economic cycles that we've had to go through, live through, navigate through. And I was just still a young guy at that time, kind of one of the lower people at the company, whoever the lowest person at the company was at the time, I think I reported to him or her. That was a very difficult time because it was so Texas centric. And so all of a sudden we went from building product like crazy to being in a completely oversupplied market, and capital formations just dried up. So that was a very challenging period for Transwestern, for all of our partners. And so we were really at an inflection point in 1985, 1986, where we had to decide, what do we want to do? We were a development company. Do we take our development expertise and go to markets, get on airplanes and start traveling around the country to create product where there was a need for new supply? Or do we hunker down in Texas, the markets we know and understand, and go where the pain was, who needs help and services? So we really transformed our company from a development company to a services organization, providing management, leasing, and disposition sales for institutional owners who had a lot of problems on their hands. And so we ended up actually growing the company pretty dramatically during a very difficult period, but we had to be very nimble and comfortable with course corrections and pivoting our entire company. It ended up wearing well with us over time. And so that was actually, even though a very difficult period, in hindsight, when you look back, you're saying that's really what helped develop our character and build our fortitude and, frankly, enhance the culture of the company.
And I want to come back to talking about some of the cycles that I know you've lived and led through. But before we go there, and before we talk a little bit more about Transwestern, why did you decide to leave McDermott, and what attracted you to the then Transwestern business? And obviously, I think it's a really important question because of your tenure at the company and the fact that you've only held two roles in your entire professional career. That's very abnormal, especially for a lot of the guests that I've had on the podcast. So I'm curious to kind of see if we can go back to that point in time and understand what you were feeling or what you saw in Transwestern and you know, kind of what attracted you to the business day zero.
Well, Transwestern was actually a little bit of a smaller company than McDermott. So McDermott was a fine company and a terrific leader in Joe McDermott. But what I saw in Transwestern was this young, energetic, passionate, driven, high quality, high character group of young professionals that really I could just sense was going to go somewhere, and I wanted to be part of that. And you really can't tell the Transwestern story without starting with Robert Duncan. Robert founded the company in 1978, so it was a five-year-old company when I arrived. And even though I've had only two, I've only been with two firms, I've had a number of different jobs at Transwestern working my way up to my current role. So I think I just saw more opportunity for a younger person who believed that he could be part of a team to add value and create opportunity for investors and clients and our own team members, if you will. I just saw more opportunity there. And it was a little bit of a flyer. Caroline and I, when we made the move, we just got married. In fact, in the fall of 1983, Caroline and I got married. I moved from McDermott to Transwestern, and we bought our first house. So it's a really big, like 30-day period. And as you indicated, 41 years later, I still have two of the three. We sold our first house. But other than that, Caroline and I are still happily married, and I'm still happily working in the Transwestern platform of companies.
So I think that's a perfect transition. So let's start with, what is Transwestern today? And then I'm really curious to hear the story behind the evolution, because I know, you know, as you started to mention previously, the business kind of grew up and evolved during a really tough time, which gave you a lot of grit and fortitude and helped the business evolve. So who are you today? Kind of headlines, you know, scope, personnel, any metrics that you share to help us frame the picture, and then we'll work backwards.
Okay. Well, we've got large investment management, development, and services companies. And then we also have a niche hospitality group in the hotel sector that's beginning to grow. So we have four firms today. We're a national privately held company. We like those two words in combination. We think that's the right size and the right formation for what we're trying to do with our partnership. We're in 33 markets. A couple of our metrics: we manage and lease a little over 320 million square feet of space across the country. Most of that, two-thirds of that's office space. So we have really developed on the services side some really good practices around office management and leasing. It's a tough sector right now, so we try and add a lot of value there. And then our investment management and development companies, where in aggregate, we have a little over $10 billion of AUM. We primarily invest in multifamily and in industrial logistics, and we can get into that in a minute why. So we look at it as we're under one umbrella, commonly held firms, but each of them have a different mandate. And so we were very intentional a number of years ago in trying to create people that were focused in a particular area. We just thought the business was not going to the generalists. It was going more specialized. So we have an investment management company, a development company, and a national services company. But I would say that, you know, we're one of the largest privately held real estate companies in the country. We've obviously got much bigger competitors, global competitors, and then we've got niche local or regional players. But we don't like to think of us as a mid-sized player. We just like to think of us as the right-sized player. And the reason I draw that distinction is we offer our institutional investors and clients national coverage from coast to coast. And then we have two international relationships to provide global coverage for our occupier solutions groups and other, when we need global connectivity, we have that as well. But the 33 offices, we're in the 33 markets you would generally think we would be in, where there's the most commerce. We'll add a few more probably, but we're not in an arms race to get to a certain number. We're just looking, where can we add value? Where is there a real business opportunity? And where do we believe the future of those firms are going to be an attractive landing spot for investment capital?
And across those three business lines, kind of how did things evolve? I know you started talking about the mid-80s when, you know, you developed a services business line to help a lot of people. But let's go back and talk a little bit about the evolution of Transwestern. What came first? And, you know, I guess how intentional was it, you know, back in the early 80s when the business was just evolving, to develop these three distinct business lines? Or was it more kind of as needed or as the market, you, where you saw opportunities in the market?
We started as a development company. That's all we were doing from 78 to the mid 80s. Yes, we managed and leased product, but it was only the product we built. And so we did no third party work. And then when that mid 80s crash happened, I would attribute it more to, it wasn't brilliant strategic planning as much as it was a survival mode. And that was a very difficult period of time. We built 57 projects. We had 37 lenders through the mid 80s. Everything crashed. All of our competitors went through the same thing we did. There was no liquidity. We were small enough that we were able to orchestrate a global debt restructure with our lenders. They worked with us. We worked with them. You know, we didn't throw the keys at anybody and say, it's your problem. And what happened with all of that was those lenders and institutional owners ended up being some of our best clients for the next 40 plus years. So the transition from development to services was really out of necessity. But then as things normalized into the 90s a little bit, to the degree everything you could ever say anything in our business is normal, because it's not. But when the opportunity came back for development and investment, the investment side of the business, we quickly went back to sort of our roots and got back in the development business, formed the investment management company, but stayed very committed to the services business. The services business is sort of the national platform, the backbone of the firm, which gives us the local market insights that you really need, local market understandings across the country in those 33 and even more markets, markets that are related to those outside of those markets. So we've always valued that services, I mean, the services company, because of the insights you gain by managing and leasing and selling properties in different markets all over the country. And our development company and investment management company have benefited from those local market insights. So part of it was out of necessity and need. And then beyond that, we sort of went back and really valued a diversified business platform. And we didn't want to diversify for diversity's sake exclusively, but we just saw value and benefit in what we call the operator model of real estate. Is we've done everything you need to do in most of these projects. So when we're meeting with clients and investors, we can talk to them as granularly as we need to about how things really operate in the numerous things you can do to add value to an asset or a portfolio. So we ultimately, it became more intentional to stay in the broader platform, but we also wanted to do it from a private construct. We like our partners working with each other, working on the things we believed in, and really being instructed by our clients and investors. All of our growth is really to be attributed to them. They believed in us and helped fuel the growth that we've enjoyed over the past 46 years as a company.
So let's break down each one of those silos a little bit more. So on the development side today, you know, let's go development, services, and investment management. You already talked a little bit about your focus on investment management, but development, what does that look like? Where are you focusing your time and energy today, Transwestern?
So since 2012, I believe we've built 130 projects, ground up development, and then we've had a number of fee developments. We'll do large fee developments for municipalities or areas of large nonprofits. And the majority of that product type, especially in the last 7 or 8 years, has been in the industrial logistics space and in the multifamily space. Back in the 80s and 90s, we did some office buildings, lots of them. And then for a company our size, and then we diversified from there. But then about a decade ago, we moved out of the office building development business, except for a fee for others, and really into owning the industrial and in multi-spaces. We just thought that was worth a lot of tailwinds. So we had high conviction around that. A lot of that was research-centric, research-driven. We just looked and said, let's go to the sectors that have wind at their backs. What are those? we were a company that came through the 80s, we know what the stiff wind in your face feels like. So we were trying to avoid some of that. We also liked the healthcare space. Again, we thought that was we thought the demographics behind that were good. We had special connectivity in Houston around the hospital systems. And so we do a lot of fee development for hospitals and hospital systems and a lot of services work for them as well. So the development, but think about development with us is more industrial and then more multifamily than anything else. And most of that is driven around that, you know, durable utility is kind of the way we like to think about it. We just thought it was those product types are going to be, there's almost necessity retail, if you will, if you believe that the Amazon effect didn't a blip, which we don't believe that. We believe online shopping and distribution of that product is going to continue. So we like those two spaces. And then roof over your head for multi, we like that. So for development, it's been a good space for us. We've been in a good sector for those two spaces over the last decade, obviously slow in the last year or two, but that's worn well with us as well.
And you're doing the development, you're vertically integrated inside of your development business. So you're doing kind of everything in-house, you know, the majority of stuff in-house, I presume.
We are. We outsource the architectural work and we outsource the general contractor work, but we have our own development teams. We have our construction managers that interface with the GCs. And so it's a very efficient system. And most of our partners have been together for many years. So we're sort of cycle tested in that regard.
And then on the services side of the business, you mentioned the 33 markets. Where's that business focused from a kind of, you know, wallet share perspective, if you will? Is it, you know, are there specific sectors that you're more or less, you know, engaged in on the services side? And what are the kind of range of services that you're offering to clients today?
So it's a very diversified national practice. If you looked at our agency leasing, our property management, our capital markets space, in our occupier solution, the tenant rep business, those four businesses are almost equal in they comprise about 90% of our business, and they're all in the low 20s% of our revenue top line. And then we have some construction management and some ancillary services. So it's been pretty diversified. We like the agency leasing and property management and the linkage there. I would say the tenant rep business on our side has grown more, some of that through acquisitions. We've acquired a few really top regional companies within the last 18 months, two in Washington, D.C., one in Chicago. And the one in Chicago was a full service company, also did management and leasing, but did some tenant rep too. So the tenant rep side of the business has been growing, and we've always been pretty strong on the agency side, probably attributable to our development background, where we came up kind of from that angle. So I think that's been we're fortunate to have really good leadership there running that company. And we're actually in a good place because serving institutional owners' needs today is not viewed as a commodity. If you can do something better than your competitors when things are tough, not everything's leasing. If you can help differentiate product and deliver outsized returns on the services business, it's no different than development or investment management. You get recognized for that. And, you know, the institutional owners around the country have viewed us as a good alternative. We have some great global competitors in that space, as you know, and we view that as just great competition and keeps us on the balls of our feet, kind of leaning forward as opposed to ever becoming complacent or satisfied.
Anything surprise you about the services business that you maybe, you know, it's a competitive space, as you alluded to, with lots of great competitors around the world, but kind of what's been most surprising to you about that business?
I would say it's a very hard business. So it's a business you better be prepared to roll up your sleeves and really get your hands dirty and like that. And if that suits you and you're okay with that, I think you can do very well in that business, but it's very competitive, lots of price compression. So our view over the last few decades is we've just got to get more efficient at what we're doing because we don't want to ever get into a position where it doesn't make enough money. So we like it's hard to make huge margins, but if you really enhance your efficiencies and are paid a decent wage, you can make a good margin in that business. So I would say that's been, it's not a surprise, but it's a reality that you better be happy with that part of the business. And then we learned early on that it's great to have property management business. A lot of people view that as, that's just a commodity kind of a role, but we've done real well with it. And the recurring income is a good thing. And a lot of our global competitors and public companies have recognized the value of that recurring revenue. So that tends to be a very competitive business. But, you know, if anything, I'd just say people are very resilient and they're staying in there because it's an important part of your platform. In other words, it's very vital to everything else we're doing. So we're going to figure out a way to be successful and make a good margin in that business because it helps fuel everything else we're doing. But in and of itself, we look at it as on a standalone basis, this has to be successful. We look at that with all of our businesses. Yes, there's synergies back and forth, but we don't want anybody being the little brother that has to be drug along to the party. Everybody's got to show up at the party on their own. But it's a tough business.
Yeah, we'll come back to maybe talking about some of what you're seeing in terms of trends on a go-forward basis and across the different businesses. But before we go there, the third business line is your investment management business. Maybe give us the slightly deeper dive on that one as well.
Transwestern Investment Group, we formed the firm in 2013 and maybe 12. So we've been at 11 or so years out of it after the GFC. And it's similar to development in that we developed these high conviction theses that were really grounded in research. And just like I indicated in development, our primary acquisition targets are in the same industrial logistics spaces and in the multifamily space. So about 40% of our fund today is devoted to industrial, about 40% is multi, and then about 20% is special situations. And those special situations are around distress, which we have plenty of today, right? And so we have continued along raising funds in a series. We have a flagship fund series. We're involved in our fourth fund there. And then we also have separate accounts. And a number of those separate accounts are large institutions that have a precise and narrow mandate that they'd like us to help them with. And interestingly, one of the biggest ones of ours in that space is one of those lenders back in the late 70s and early 80s. We worked hard to help during a bad time, and we were going through a bad time, so were they. And they just sort of never forgot it. And so we've been able to build that into a massive practice that covers all three of our companies. So sort of a good story of trying to always do the right thing by people, which many people in our business do, a lot of high integrity people in our business. And we like to think that that's part of what our makeup is at Transwestern.
So in the investment management business, your flagship vehicles are closed end, kind of commingled discretionary vehicles.
Correct. Correct. And again, really good set of investors in that who've been with us for a while and have fueled that growth. And again, we're really looking for that durable utility of product. And so we want to, it's not that we don't chase the new shiny object, but if we do, we better know something about it. So we look at spaces. So again, I've commented numerous times about our industrial logistics and our multifamily bias. But we like the healthcare space. We're beginning to look at the seniors housing space for the first time around a particular opportunity. We like the sports and entertainment business. Interestingly, we have a sports and entertainment vertical within the services company. So I don't think we would just launch off and chase something that we weren't grounded in and have some real operational expertise to bring to the table and kind of seeing where that business is going and where the real opportunity is. You know, data centers is obviously on everybody's mind today. Another thing that when it pops up, you better know something about it because those things are all complex. But I think if you look at things like sports and entertainment in the healthcare medical space, we've been doing that work for a long time. So raising money around it, around a thesis and a mandate is something that we think we bring something to the table. Otherwise, I don't think we're not interested in trying to learn anything on the go.
I'm fascinated by organizational design. And when you started describing Transwestern, I think you described it as a family of companies or maybe a platform of companies. And what that implies to me is these kind of separate but connected entities. Whereas if I look across the industry, some firms don't make that distinction around a family or platform of companies. It's we're a vertically integrated XYZ type of company. So what's behind that? And what does that actually mean to either employees or investors or partners to, you know, to Transwestern family of companies?
It's an astute question, Brandon. And the reason it is we're in the process of moving to a more integrated model. So we've been in the services business since the mid 80s, of course, as I mentioned. And then we started trying to plug in development and acquisitions kind of as a part of that whole, another club in the bag. And it really wasn't happening for us in the late 90s and early 2000s. And so by 2010, we said, look, we've got to create the specific vertical around development, investment management, and people that are in those spaces. We don't want them doing anything else. We don't want them diluted by management or leasing or anything else. So we brought in leadership to create those companies, and they were somewhat siloed, and it was by design. We had fiduciary obligations. We're a registered investment advisor with the SEC. So our investment management company has a fiduciary obligation to our investor. We wanted to be siloed. But then a couple of years ago, we brought in the McKinsey company to help us scale and grow and saying, you know what? We've got a good track record. We've enjoyed some success, but we don't want to incrementally grow. How do we grow transformationally? And one of their findings, if you will, is don't turn into a big generalist company. Keep your specialists, but become more integrated as firms. Keep separate what you need to keep separate to fulfill your fiduciary obligation to your investors. But we're in the process now, 2 years into the Transwestern Transformation Plan, TTP, that actually is, because our other two companies that are 11 or 12 years old are maturing to the point that it really does need to become more integrated for the benefit of our clients and our investors. And I think those, we will probably, to your question, be looking more integrated, more like some of our big competitors than we have over the past decade.
I think it's interesting, and, you know, hats off to you for going through this transformation. I talk to a lot of companies, and it's old habits die hard. And I'm not saying you have old habits, but knowing that the businesses need to evolve with the markets and reflecting on what you could be doing different or start doing is a sign of great leadership. And, you know, on the topic of leadership, I know that's something that's, you know, we've talked before, and I know that that's very near and dear to your heart. And I'm just curious, you know, having kind of been at the helm of Transwestern now for, you know, a while, kind of what are your philosophies on leadership, and, you know, how might, you know, some of the employees or team members think of you as a leader at the company?
Well, I do think that there are some key principles you can read about or learn about both in our industry and in multiple industries. A lot of that crosses over. I've always looked at sports and business, having a lot of analogous examples back and forth. I think leadership needs, I love that Stephen Covey principle with beginning with the end in mind, because I think part of leadership is to have a vision for what a company can be. And I think our leadership team has really worked hard to cohesively build that in different cycles. And then what can we be? And then to have that vision, but then impart that vision to a large group of people who will buy into the vision. In other words, I think part of great leadership creates a following. It's hard to do things by yourself or with two or three or four people. We're an organization of 2,200 people, team members around the country. How do we get 2,200 people moving in the same direction? So part of that's building a following around a vision people buy into. And they say, you know what? I want to be part of the company that's going there. And so part of that, I think, is being very transparent and being willing to communicate both good news and bad news. And so if you're transparent in what you're communicating, I think people will tend to buy into it more because you're more authentic about what you're saying, what you really believe. And people are very smart. They can discern who believes what they're saying and who doesn't. And if you care for people and you care for other team members, they pick up on that. And so I do think it's really important to have servant leaders at the top of an organization who are trying to do something for the greater good of the entire organization and all the people that are committing their time to meeting the goals of the organization. And so there's a duty back and forth that we sort of owe each other. And so I would say that we work hard at that. And we also don't view it's just any one person. It's not one person. It's an aligned group of professionals that are equally committed and yoked to the same task and effort. And I think good leaders also tend to be real good listeners. So you got to listen to what your clients and investors are saying, and you got to listen to what your team members around the country are saying. Oftentimes they're as close to the investor or client or closer than anybody. So we get a lot of bottom-up feedback from around the country that ends up as company policy, but it comes from someone that's highly attuned to what our investors and clients are saying. So we look at that as a real opportunity from a leadership standpoint.
Is there anything that you do to empower people to be able to share those perspectives? Because I think you're absolutely right that listening is critical. And oftentimes the people who are closest to the clients aren't sitting at the pinnacle of the organization from an organizational design or structure perspective. So how do you empower people across these different businesses to be able to share that information so that it gets to people who can have an impact if they can't directly?
Well, we do have a broad-based partnership. We have lots of people that are contributing their time and they invest in deals that we generate. So we've got alignment of interest financially. Again, I think we communicate frequently. One of the benefits of being a privately held company is all we worry about are our people and our clients. That's what we're focused on. We're not diluted by other things that others may have to worry about. Now, there's benefits to being a public company too. And so everybody has benefits and everybody has flat sides to their strategy. But one of the benefits of being a national privately held company is you have plenty of time to pour into your people. And you mentioned the word empowerment. We're a huge believer of empowerment and giving people the responsibility and accountability of achieving a corporate mandate. And if they do that, they'll be rewarded economically and profile. They'll be elevated. They'll be promoted. So we work really hard in that regard to have a special culture. We're sort of big on culture. Culture, I think, is kind of the outflow of some of that. I think that's sort of a result, what ends up happening. But we've been a company whose culture has been recognized across the country some, and it's not anything we've chased or tried to do. But I think our privately held platform enables us to create, generate a pretty powerful culture. And we have a lot of good retention people around the country. You know, how do you do it? You're in 33 cities, not everybody's sitting in one city. How do you stay connected? It's a challenge. It's hard. So you got to over-communicate. And you can't let people guess what the strategy of the company is. So you got to be more open and candid, transparent. We're not hiding the news. But you're right. It's part of the thing that keeps a bunch of us up at night thinking, how can we be better?
Absolutely. Let's talk a little bit about the market and cycles. I think you mentioned earlier, you've been through 5 economic cycles in your career. And, you know, we're recording this in October of 2024. Near the bottom, or hopefully, or maybe, you know, about to enter a recession, who the heck knows? But here we are, it's October 2024. How does this most recent period of economic distress and uncertainty compare to prior cycles, if at all, that you've been through? And kind of what are your views for how this might take shape over the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, you're really good at this, Brandon. Another good question. To me, these cycles have been, there's a different catalyst to every downturn. As I indicated at the outset, that if you were a Texas-based development company, there was not a worse cycle than the mid-80s. if even the GFC and for a Texas-based company. And so I think each one of the cycles has been brought about by a different set of dynamics. And at the very outset, you didn't know how bad it was going to get. And so there was lots of consternation around, what's the real catalyst of this? What's the cause of it? Is it real estate driven, or is it capital markets driven, or is it, you know, some kind of a global, usually it's around debt, right? Too much debt, too much leverage seems to be at the base of all of it. And so a couple of things. So on the cycle, and then I'll compare it to the current one. Each cycle that we went through, I learned this from Robert Duncan during the mid 80s. The most important thing to do is to communicate very openly with your team member base and your clients exactly how bad it is from your perspective. Do not pull punches. The Transwestern people and people that are in our business, they're smart. If you don't tell them what's going on, they're going to have an opinion. They may even think it's worse than what it is. So I think being open and transparent and immediately communicating to people, hey, here's what's going on. One of our strategies in through the great financial crisis and through COVID, say the last two, 07, 08, and then the global pandemic, is we did not know how severe, how long it would be. We knew both of them were going to be severe. It just happened immediately, right? It just was like dropped like a rock. So we had to do something quickly, particularly with our overhead base. Well, in both cases, we said, you know what? Our best asset are our people. And we're not going to first go to mass layoffs. We're just not going to do it. So what we did is we went to all of our team members and we said, look, everyone in the country for right now, but everyone in the country, we're going to keep everybody's job, but everyone's going to take a temporary salary reduction. And the leadership is going to take the biggest percentage cut all the way down the ranks to the least compensated individuals. But even those people were going to take a small cut. We wanted shared sacrifice to be part of the mandate to tighten the belt. And that would ultimately have an effect on other expenses within the company. Now, you can't go on 6, 7, 8 years. So if these things would have been prolonged, we'd have had to do something more draconian, I'm sure. But it was really important for us in both cases to create that shared sacrifice, lower expenses like immediately, which we were able to do. If you take temporary salary reductions and it starts in 2 weeks, you can immediately impact, you know, your bottom line. In both cases, the recoveries happened a little quicker than we all thought. So when we were able, we said our salary restorations would be our number one priority coming out of it. And we immediately restored. But what happened was we had our entire team on the field ready to play. We didn't have to go rehire people and wonder where they're coming from. And are they going to be as good as the people we, you know, had to lay off? We didn't do any of that. So in those two cases, because the duration of the downturn wasn't quite as long as it could have been, that the strategy prevailed. And so it actually, what it ended up doing is building culture. Everyone saw that, hey, the company values all these jobs and all these positions. And I'm willing to take a temporary small salary cut if all my coworkers are still coming to work with me every day. So that worked out actually pretty well. And I would say the current down cycle, our latest one, I think we've hit the bottom, and I think we're going to come out of it. The Federal Reserve, I tend to be not one of those that bash the Fed every 5 minutes. I think those are real smart people. I think they have the best information on the planet. I didn't, you know, like everything they did, but I think that basically they did the right thing. They've navigated us to a softer landing than most people predicted 2, 3 years ago when everyone said we're going into an immediate recession. So I think the Fed, when they decided to tame inflation by basically slamming the brakes on the economy and raise interest rates the way they did, there's that old saying that says when the economy gets a cold, real estate gets the flu. And that's sort of what happened. So we, in our business, the capital really made it tough. So I think we've bottomed out in that regard. I think we'll come out of it. I actually think we'll come out of it pretty quick. And the reason I say that is the demand drivers behind the parts of the of our space that were doing well going into the downturn, those will be the first one to accelerate out. and you're going to be in a supply constrained market for the next year or two. So as we come out of it, we're not going to be delivering the same number of square footage in both industrial, multi, and some of these other sectors. And so I think we'll actually have some demand that'll absorb the supply that is created, and we'll be pretty satisfied with how we come out of it. I'm not predicting recession or not, but I've been saying for 3 years, I didn't think we were actually going to go into a technical recession. And I think the Fed's done a fairly decent job of navigating a very difficult fact set.
Based on what you see across the different business lines that Transwestern's in, kind of what are you focusing your time and your team's time on as we come out of this period in terms of whether we want to call them best ideas or asset classes? You mentioned this supply-demand imbalance is going to create quite a bit of opportunity. Obviously, you guys are developers as well, so you can control to some extent. I mean, capital is required, but you have some role in the supply side. And on the services side, you have a really good perspective, I would imagine, in demand across these asset classes. So with that kind of setting, what are you focusing your energy and your team's energy on over the next, you know, we'll call it 12 to 24 months?
Brandon, I got to tell you, you know, we were in the midst of the Transwestern Transformation Plan, and then we hit this dramatic slowdown. So, you know, we're very much believers that an automobile has an accelerator and a brake for a reason. And we were braking where we needed to brake, and we were accelerating where we needed to accelerate. I actually think we're looking forward to a pretty exciting growth period over the next 2 to 3 years. We're probably 12 months away from that. I think 25 will be better than 24, but 26 will be better than 25. So I think we'll build back in to a pretty good, and I think we're just going to pick right up on the transformation plan and continue a very specific growth strategy around each of our sectors: investment management, development, and services. So we're viewing it, you know, we did manage risk well during the downturn. In hindsight, we did not over leverage. We didn't get all the leverage we could possibly get on everything. We liked putting plenty of equity ahead of our debt, our senior debt, both at the fund level and on ground up developments. And so we find ourselves in pretty good shape relative to where we could be. You could certainly create, there's tougher things going on out there, and we were in good sectors that basically our properties are leased. So if your properties are leased, you're just going to have to grind through and hold them a little longer than you thought, or maybe turn the rents one more time on another term or two. But we're in a pretty good shape to be back in a growth mode. And I don't see a lot of constraints on the horizon as we come out of this. But we, you know, you never come out of it quite as fast as you think. But I do think you've got to be opportunistic and looking for today. What are going to be those big drivers coming out of this thing? We obviously have our high conviction components, but there's going to be some others that we know really well, sectors we really know and understand well, which I think we're going to be able to capitalize on in some of the distress that we'll continue to see.
Anything you want to share here? I don't want you to give away your best ideas to everybody listening, but any insights where those sectors or focuses might be going forward?
I touched on a few of them. I just believe healthcare is big. You know, life sciences is something that there's been a lot of talk about, but the demand has been questionable, right? You know, especially during when the capital's not there for IPOs and whatnot. So the life science space over the next 10 or 20 years is clearly going to do well. It'll be interesting to see how that demand emerges and what the credit of that demand is and what you can really build for that demand. But healthcare is going to be very strong. I think seniors that's a tough subset to run. It's an operator model kind of a deal, but there's some seniors models out there that are good. I said sports and entertainment. I mean, it's an area we're putting a lot of elbow grease behind. And you asked what I like doing. I actually like working on a lot of that. I like working on fundraising and having relationships with our capital sources. I like working on some of our larger assignments. It helps me. And our leadership team does as well. We're a pretty flat organization. So if you look at what Robert and I work on, Steve Harding and our presidents of our various companies, and Adam, it's we like getting in there with our clients We think that's one of our value adds. I like to hear from them the things they're looking for from us, because we're constantly funding new technologies and new this and new that. Well, if I hear every one of our investors and clients asking for the same thing, we're going long. We're going to pour money into that. And if I've been in 10 meetings and no one's asking for this, which everybody wants funded, we're not funding it because no one wants it. And so I think that's part of the fun and the beauty of the business, is just staying really close to your clients and your investors. And it's constantly changing, right? The pace of technological change has never been faster. So you've got to have your ear right on the ground, and you got to have your hands on the wheel. And we have a lot of hands on the wheel intentionally. So we're looking forward to the next period. But it's like anything else. And I don't care what side of the cycle you're in. There's so many smart people out in our space, and there's lots of capital in our space. A lot of it's on the sidelines ready to pounce when the opportunity arises. And some of them are beginning to do that now. And we're kind of in that camp. So I think it's going to be a really exciting next 2 or 3 years, but there'll be lots of struggles along the way too.
I kind of think of it as a journey, and as, you know, you're walking down the trail or driving down the road, you know, using a metaphor that you've, you know, used earlier. Are there specific markers that you're looking at to say, this validates that we're on the right path, or this wasn't what I expected from an economic, you know, perspective, or this marker doesn't align to where I thought it would be. Maybe we should think about pivoting or recalibrating, changing direction, if you will.
We do a lot of that. So we do a lot of pivoting and recalibrating, but we always try and set a goal and a standard. One thing McKinsey taught us that was really valuable is to be more metric driven on everything that we do. It doesn't mean you're always going to hit the metric. But if you don't have a firm target and a goal that you're shooting for, that, you know, metrics all the way up, you could wake up one day and find out, hey, I'm way over. How did I get way over here? You know, I took my eye off the road or whatever. So I do think we like to make course corrections, and we like to pivot based on opportunities that we believe in, that we have high conviction around. But I do believe we're going to be more metric driven and let that help drive our transformation to become even a larger and even more capable firm.
So transitioning away from the economy and the outlook to kind of things that give you energy in addition to your time at Transwestern, I know you mentioned you went to Baylor. I believe, you know, you've been very involved in, from an advisory or board perspective, in, you know, in the health system at Baylor and throughout Texas. And talk to me a little bit about kind of what it is that you do to give back to the community, and kind of why that's important to you from a leadership and philanthropic perspective.
Hey, thank you for asking that, Brandon. I like many people in our industry, I do have a passion for a number of institutions and causes. I had the great opportunity to serve as a board of regent at Baylor University for 9 years. I rolled off of that as a term limit. You served three-year terms there. That was in Waco. I'm actually still on the board at the Baylor College of Medicine. Again, back to that healthcare, change the world through better healthcare. I've been on that board for 14 years. It's one of the largest research institutions in the Southwest U.S., the Baylor College of Medicine is. And so some of the groundbreaking work being done to help immunize the bottom billion on the planet is just to have a small part in that. I'm a trustee in that great institution with many highly committed trustees and a great group of people. I also have a passion for the homeless. Solve that problem. Houston, I was on a board called Search for a number of years in Houston, which was dedicated to ending homelessness in Houston, which sounds like such a, who would ever have a goal to end homelessness? Come on, it's impossible. And actually, Houston, over the past 11 or 12 years, has cut the homeless population in half. It's the greatest story in the country right now about how a municipality and a local city government, starting with the mayor, work with all of the nonprofits dealing with homelessness and have a real strategy to reduce homelessness by 50%, and we're going further. So we say now, okay, let's do get rid of homelessness. How about zero? Again, it sounds crazy unless you take it from 9,000 to 4,500, which we've done, then you're going, okay, maybe we just keep going. And I would just say to that, to all that, it gives you a, there's a sense of fulfillment that comes out of that. Whatever you give, you get back tenfold. And there's so many people dedicated to so many causes. And I look at our business is so classic, right? Our business, we serve clients, we serve capital, we serve institutions, and we sort of have that servant mindset. We don't leave the office and drop that servant mindset. People go home and, okay, I'm going to make my community better, or I'm going to make my neighborhood better. I would say do it with the things you have the most passion around. And those are the most exciting things to get involved with. And if something happens with that nonprofit or wherever you're serving that's tough, and you've got to help grind through and get to a new solution, you won't look around saying, oh my gosh, why did I accept this board position? You said, I'm exactly where I need to be. They're lucky to have me here, and I'm going to help them work out of a hard spot. So thank you for asking that question, Brandon, because that is it's a really important part of a lot of leadership within this company and within many of my national competitors who I'm friends with, many of those individuals. And it's great to see they do the same thing. So it's a sort of one of our, I think it's an attribute to be in the commercial real estate business that most people possess, want to give back and make the world a better place.
I always like to ask for advice for young people or any people in the industry from leaders like yourself before we wrap up. So if you could give advice to somebody who's in the real estate business today, whether it's in the services business, development business, investment management, they love real estate like you do. What advice would you give to them as they think about evolving their career inside of their organization?
So again, if you're a younger professional, I would say be a really good listener. I don't see great listening all the time with younger professionals. I see it with people that have been in the business for a minute because they've learned that somebody, the investor usually tells you the answer if you're quiet long enough to slow your own pitch down so you're listening to their needs. So I would say be a great listener, be flexible and be highly attuned and be willing to make a course correction or a pivot. You don't have to lack conviction to do that, but you may have to be convinced to do that. But once you're convinced, you know, be flexible in how you think about the world, because you don't know everything and nobody does. And so listening and having mentors and being a mentor is very important in my view. And then I'd say for the youngest people in the crowd and that listen to your podcast, Brandon, I'd say marry well. I started out with talking about Caroline and I have been married 41 years. The amount of encouragement I've gotten from Caroline over the years through all of those cycles we talked about and all of the, it's been just fabulous. And it's just, I've never had to, I don't go to work encumbered by, oh my gosh, my, you know, the home life is, you know, a wreck or whatever. So it's been great for Caroline and I and for our three kids who I'm fortunate to have great, we are fortunate to have great relationships with and their spouses now. Spend time on that. Spend time on your family, your whatever faith you're choosing to pursue, your professional career, your community service. It sounds impossible. My gosh, how can I do all this stuff? I actually think you'll be way better and more productive at work when you're sort of hitting on all cylinders during your life, but you've just got to be committed to it. And so I would say to the younger professionals in our industry, that sounds like a lot, but just don't compromise. Make sure you take care of yourself and your family, and you'll actually perform better at work.
I think that advice is equally applicable to everyone, young and old and early and advanced in their career. So I appreciate that, Larry. I think that's wonderful advice. And unfortunately, we're out of time, so I'm going to have to wrap up now, but I've really enjoyed our conversation. I appreciate your candor and sharing the story of Transwestern, your career, your philosophies on leadership, and I'm looking forward to our next conversation.
Thanks, Brandon. Me too. It's great seeing you again.
Thanks for listening to the latest episode of The Distribution by Juniper Square. If you liked today's podcast, please share it with a colleague or a friend And don't forget to subscribe and rate The Distribution on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can connect with me on LinkedIn by going to www.linkedin.com/IN/B Sedloff, or you can find me on Twitter at B Sedloff. You can also find a video recording of this conversation on demand at junipersquare.com/the-distribution. Until next time.